This is the Capital City Recap with Michael Cohen on More Compelling Talk Radio, 1320 WILS.
1320 WILS. It is Thursday, 88 and cloudy, low 70 tonight. It's just hot. And then things are slowly going to taper off. For tomorrow, a high of 82, low 58. And then Saturday, a high of 75. Really, 70s is a high for the weekend. So it is going to cool off a bit, which is sort of nice. So we know that the health insurance issue we're facing now is complex, but how did we end up here? Christy Ford Chapin is a history professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and she's actually researched this closely. She's the author of Insuring America's Health, the Public Creation of the Corporate Healthcare System. Christy, great to have you on WILS.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me, Michael.
Yeah, and how far back did you go in researching how we ended up here?
I actually went back to the late 19th century to figure out what was going on, how the market was developing, and then some of the interventions that organized physicians and government officials made to develop the market.
The late 1800s, and what were people thinking about health care back then?
Well, really what you had at the end of the 19th century and for the first three or four decades of the 20th century were a lot of different kinds of experiments in the marketplace. I mean, you had everything from ethnic and African-American mutual aid societies to labor unions, businesses, and also physicians themselves looking for various ways to organize and finance healthcare.
So if you needed to see a doctor, would you simply have to pay him, or was there another way it worked?
Well, actually, they did have insurance programs back then, but instead of paying the insurer every month, you would either perhaps you would work it through your union, or one popular way was paying directly to a doctor group. So there'd be like a multi-specialty physician group that provided you with insurance. You pay them a set fee every month, and in return, you get unlimited care. They would sometimes also on the back end negotiate with hospitals in order to so that you had were able to be admitted to the hospital as well.
The procedures were probably a lot simpler back then, right? They didn't have all these intricate medications that we have today, right?
Well, the thing that's so interesting about that period is that was right when you get the beginning of modern medicine. So at the end of the 19th century, once you have the widespread acceptance of germ theory, that's when you get the ascendancy of modern medicine with the first effective medications and vaccinations, the complex surgeries, anesthesia. So there's a lot of excitement about medicine. The first time people are really, because before that, physicians competed with a wide range of practitioners because they really couldn't offer much more effective medicine compared to, say, a herbal practitioner or a midwife.
They're all kind of in the same plane in some way, it sounds like. Tell me this, was it as costly as it is today, procedures and medications?
No, one of the arguments I make is that particularly on if you look at all these other models that people were trying out in the marketplace, they did find a lot of ways to keep down costs, and that's what's so interesting. One of the experiments that I sometimes highlight because it was so elegant was the prepaid physician group where you had a multi-specialty practice. So instead of just all orthopedists or all general practitioners, you had all the different specialists practicing together, and they kind of owned the full health profile of a patient because the patient had one-stop shopping, and the costs were very well controlled because the physicians were tied to the bottom line.
I see, there's like an annual fee for that or something like that?
Yeah, so there'd be a monthly fee, and the great thing about that is the physicians being responsible for the bottom line, they were not incentivized to either ration care, which we know can be a problem in some systems, and they also were not incentivized to over-provide care, because if they ration care, they'd lose patients, and that would hurt them financially, but if they just provided a lot of, unnecessary tests and procedures, there was no reason to run up a bill because they're not sending it off to a third-party insurance company. They own that risk. They themselves are underwriting the risks And I argue that physicians are the ones that you want to incentivize correctly so that you get that patient-physician relationship and the decisions being made there between the physician and the patient rather than by an insurance company official or government.
And we're seeing that model maybe attempted at least now in modern days. Christy Ford Chapin with us. He's a professor of history, University of Maryland, Baltimore County. The book, by the way, Ensuring America's Health. So at what point did these insurance companies come about?
So, yeah, that's a really interesting part of the story is it was at the end of the 1930s, the American Medical Association, which represented physicians, I think a lot of people know the story about them is that they opposed government intervention in the healthcare sector, but they also opposed market experimentation. They were also against competitive markets during this period. So they were against all these different experiments I'm talking to you about, including the prepaid physician groups.
Okay. So that's strange. So they're against government intervention and they're against competitive markets.
Exactly. I know. So they were fighting a two-front battle, and it was getting a little difficult. And there was a lot of federal pressure on them during the Great Depression and New Deal, and they realized that we can't just keep fighting all these different market ways of providing health care. They were against insurance. That was their policy.
They just wanted essentially a direct connection between patient and doctor?
Yeah, they kind of had this 19th century romantic image, you know, physician, patient, no insurance, doctor practicing individually. But that just did not, you know, in an increasingly industrialized society, consumers demanding more and more care because now it's more effective. It just wasn't going to work. So they actually just kind of out of thin air came up with their own model. It's this insurance company model that we have today. That's when they said, okay, look, we will accept insurance, but we're not going to accept it through physician groups or unions or mutual aid societies. It has to be through insurance companies because they thought, you know, the insurance company was located far away from most doctors. So they thought that gave them the best shot of keeping the insurance company or a third party out of their practice. And then, of course, they also set it up so it would be fee-for-service billing. So rather than physicians receiving, you know, either a salary or a per capita, you know, per year payment for each patient or subscriber they saw, instead they wanted to be paid for every single service and procedure they offered, including within one doctor visit.
Well, so this is a great deal for doctors, basically.
Yes, it really was.
They started making a lot more money at that point, I'm guessing.
Exactly. Yeah. And also, you know, most physicians were not, you know, completely unethical. That they're just responding to the way they're incentivized, the way I feel like any of us would respond. But it also did, of course, encourage a lot of fraudulent surgeries. There was like a crisis in the 1950s about unnecessary surgeries, like, you know, the removal of people getting their appendix removed and hysterectomies that were unnecessary.
When did the insurance companies become these you know, massive institutions that basically control the system?
Well, that's the interesting thing. It's a very ironic story, right? Because physicians set up this model hoping to escape third-party power, but what they inadvertently did is it was a great system for physicians for many decades. But of course, because costs were rising so quickly, and this really starts to become a problem by the end of the 1940s, where you see medical care prices rising so quickly, and it was really bad publicity. It threatened both insurers and physicians, and that it made it more likely that the government would intervene with all this bad publicity about healthcare costs rising. So the physicians, as much as they didn't want to, had to accept cost containment procedures. So what you see is gradually the insurance companies getting more and more involved with the way medicine is practiced. So, you know, they start, you know, helping make sure that committees, these utilization review committees are set up in hospitals and medical societies to review what the physicians are doing. You know, then physicians have to start getting permission to admit patients to the hospital.
And essentially what did they basically, I mean, do they have all the power now? Is that where we are now?
Yeah, so it's flipped. So for example, a lot of physicians, their reimbursements are tied, for example, to preset treatment blueprints. So the insurance company has a preset, standardized way that you have to treat patients who show up with a particular diagnosis. And so, you know, my fear is that takes a lot of the art out of medicine. It certainly takes a lot of innovation away from physicians who are there on the ground and know how to change things or how certain patients might need to be treated differently. Mm-hmm. Because it's all now based on how you get billed, and so you just need to fill that box, and anything outside of that isn't worth their time to develop or figure out, because mm-hmm. it's all based on the way the insurance company, they bill the insurance company.
Christy Ford Chapin, history professor, University of Maryland, Baltimore County. So between the 40s and into, let's say, the 2000s, was it just an exponential growth for the insurance industry, or was there any point where doctors started questioning how things were going?
I would say it was pretty much growth for the insurance industry, and the reason is, even though the physicians were reluctant and unhappy with insurance company power growing, they were both allied politically, and the idea was, what physicians kept telling themselves and telling each other is, we have to accept this because we need to grow this insurance company model. We need to spread coverage under this model as quickly as we can in order to prove to government officials and politicians that we don't need reform of healthcare, because that's their big thing.
And what was all along this process, how eager has the government been to get involved, would you say?
Well, really, that's one thing I talk about in my book. I think sometimes we think, oh, there was a big, you know, push at the end of the 1940s with Harry Truman, and then again in the 1960s with the passage of Medicare and Medicaid in 1965. But the truth is, because everybody recognized how I would say broken or faulty the insurance company model was, there was actually this consistent push from pretty much immediately after the AMA put this model together, from, you know, Republicans, Democrats, you know, all different ideologies are looking at this model and saying, this isn't going to work because it's going to cause prices to go up so much, and it's going to be hard to cover people. Mm-hmm. So the one famous episode is President Truman proposes universal care at the end of the 1940s. But even after that is defeated, insurers and physicians are saying, oh my gosh, we have to quickly keep trying to cover as many people as possible under this model, even though it's difficult for insurers because in some cases they're even losing money on it. But they're saying they have to because you have, during the 1950s under President Eisenhower, Republican, you have both Eisenhower and conservative Democrats and Republicans in Congress who had opposed the Truman bill, nonetheless proposing their own government reform programs and health care programs because of the problems they see with this model.
So as far back as that time, there was an attempt to reform the system, and why did it not work back then?
Well, the AMA was a lot more politically powerful back then than it is today. Probably against the Truman Bill, for example, it's probably the largest campaign ever waged against one piece of legislation. Mm-hmm. Just between radio ads and millions of pieces of literature and, you know, speakers, and, you know, I could go on and on.
In Truman, he wanted to do what exactly?
He did want to create a universal health care system, complete, you know, everybody. What's interesting about that was the arguments were being made around the fact that what was developing in, you know, the so-called private market, although you might argue it wasn't private since the AMA had picked out a very specific model, but they were arguing that, look, this is so inefficient, at least if we put it on the universal plan, we're going to allow these prepaid doctor groups to come back. It's going to be more efficient. It's going to be less costly. So you could see what the thinking is there.
And the resistance to a single payer system, has that always been there within the public, would you say, or where is that coming from?
Well, of course, you get it from the AMA and business, but also the public. Remember, I'm sure your audience will remember, this is during the Cold War. So, of course, a lot of the political debate is around, hey, we're not going to socialize medicine or nationalize our healthcare system because we don't want to be like the Soviets. You know, we're setting ourselves up as different, free market ideology. But even among businesses that weren't insurance companies, there was a lot, like, Chamber of Commerce, National Association of Manufacturers, there was a lot of interest and energy put into defeating, like Truman's bill, because there was this idea that if the healthcare sector fell, so to speak, if the healthcare sector was nationalized, that would set a precedent for the entire economy. So there was this idea that that sector particularly had to be kept from being nationalized.
Interesting. And some say that the attempt is still there, the desire by some to put a single payer system in place. Do you think America is ever going to have such a thing? Are we built for that kind of thing?
Geez, it's so hard to tell with the way things are going now. I would say to the Republicans that the way that they've offered their reform, I think they actually make it, and I know they don't mean to, but, you know, irony certainly exists, but I think they're going to make it more likely that we have a single-payer system because they are offering something that does not fix structural problems at all and, you know, just rolls back care. I mean, if you look at what the Senate just offered today, I'm looking through it and you're looking at the analysis all I can, and I'm asking myself, I don't see where they're bending down costs. And that's a real problem when you're taking, when you're rolling back coverage from like the working poor, because my argument is, look, it's one thing to, you know, to propound or advocate for, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and all that. But when we have a system that we know is a complete mess, it's broken, the amount insurance premiums are just out of control. This is not what a normally functioning market would produce. Yet we're turning these very people who have the most difficulty affording insurance out and saying, hey, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and buy your own insurance. Well, that doesn't make sense when we've already created this system that it's impossible. There's no way somebody could afford to purchase insurance. Well, and if they don't qualify for Medicaid, for example, because, you know, they make too much money, but they don't, they're, say they, you know, work retail or some place where they're not offered insurance. So it's, you know, I know that it's not what they're intending to do, but I think they don't realize how much they're going to really set things back. And I don't really know a lot of people. I'm trying to think if I know anybody who's excited about, you know, I don't know if many conservatives are excited about it.
Well, certainly that, I mean, they're in line when it comes to what they think about the Affordable Care Act, right? The idea that it's failing on its own. But probably a much larger reform is needed. Christy Ford Chapin, professor of history at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Her book is Insuring America's Health, the Public Creation of the Corporate Healthcare System, a real look back into history. Christy, great to have you on WILS. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Enjoyed it.